payments ebbed, she took a part-time job with the facility, writing promotional literature for hospital fundraising. At the dinner table, my father sometimes spoke of writing and his attempts to sell stories, complaining about particular editors. Sometimes, as he ate, he read passages to my mother from manuscript pages stacked by his plate and asked for her opinion. She always provided honestly, and he would make pencil notations on the pages. At other times, Dad and Mom sat in the little living room overlooking the tide flats, and he read short stories and chapters to her. Only 9 years before, in college, Beverly Herbert had dreamed of becoming a professional writer herself. With the demands of married life, this dream was fading. Reality told her there couldn't be two creative writers in one family. How could they possibly support a household? In the midst of our pressing need for income, she told Dad not to worry, that if necessary, he could leave DFPA, and she would work for department stores or wherever necessary until his writing became successful. In this, and countless other ways, Beverly Herbert was totally selfless and made an incredible sacrifice, giving my father a true gift of love. She believed in his writing ability and always said he had more talent than she did, that she only had a flair for writing. "Do what's in your heart, darling," she told him. "I'll be here for you." In my mother's heart, she was sure he would become tremendously successful one day. He had such a powerful need to write, such a drive for it, that she knew she could never stand in his way, could never exert pressure on him to earn more money at the expense of his creative potential. He wasn't happy unless he was writing. Aside from sacrificing a creative writing career, she was giving up traditional home life. Mom enjoyed tinkering around the house, making a snug nest out of it, but with her career requirements, there was less time for this. Still, she sewed, knitted, wove, crocheted, and baked pies. She made clothes for all of us and darned our socks. Essentially a homebody, she might have done well as a writer working out of the house, if she'd been married to anyone else, to someone who would permit her the luxury of staying home near the typewriter. Instead, she was forced out of her element into the workplace, at a time when the vast majority of women did not work away from the home. Her faith was rewarded. Within 2 weeks of sending under pressure to New York, John W. Campbell made an offer to serialize it in Astounding Science Fiction. This was a remarkable response time for an editor. Campbell's offer was 4 cents a word, meaning the author would receive around $2,700 net after the deduction of Lurton's 10% commission. Dad accepted right away. Campbell asked for 2 synopses. He planned to run the story in 3 installments of around 25,000 words apiece, and synopses were needed to precede the second and third segments, filling the readers in on prior action. The serialization was scheduled to run from November 1955 through January 1956. Lurton turned immediately toward selling the novel in book form. Walter I. Bradbury, managing editor of Doubleday, liked the book and snapped it up in June 1955. This resulted in an additional $3,600 net to the author, so the book was starting to earn pretty good money for the mid-1950s. It allowed Dad to pay old debts, including some of the money owed to his ex-wife Flora. Doubleday was so impressed with the novel that they copy-edited it right away and scheduled it for publication in February of the following year. This was 1 short month following the serialization in Astounding Science Fiction, the earliest possible date Doubleday could publish it. The Science Fiction Book Club also picked the title up, but only paid a small amount for the rights. Inspired by Dad's success, Mom spent every available moment writing a 64,000-word mystery novel, Frighten the Mother. It was dispatched to Lurton in the summer of 1955. While he liked portions of it, he felt the manuscript needed more work and told her it was not ready for submission to publishers. Dejected, Mom set it aside. She didn't have Dad's perseverance. In late August, Dad decided it was time to get rid of our rickety old car, a Dodge, in favor of more reliable transportation.
He became aware of a most unusual set of wheels that was being advertised for sale by a funeral home in Tacoma.
Terms were agreed to, and my parents purchased a used hearse for $300, a 1940 Cadillac LaSalle. It only had 19,000 miles on it. Dad wrote an unpublished 1,000-word piece about the vehicle, which he entitled The Invisible Car. In explanation of the title, he wrote, "Nobody looks at a hearse unless he absolutely has to. They see you, but they don't look. The eyes refuse to change focus. There's no glimmer of recognition." Our car was unlike anything I had ever seen before. I hadn't even been familiar with the word hearse, but soon learned the meaning. I don't recall being that surprised. After all, I slept on a toboggan while other kids had beds. How was this so unusual? Describing the hearse years later, Dad said, it had a pre-Kettering engine. You know, before Kettering screwed it up. Charles F. Kettering, a General Motors research executive. He claimed the big heavy vehicle got 27 miles per gallon on some stretches of road. My father was known to exaggerate on occasion, but he held firm on this. He said the Cadillac had separate hand and foot throttles, so that the hand throttle could be used as a cruise control to improve fuel efficiency. The front compartment smelled of dust and old leather. A little electric fan sat on the dashboard, and a cracked leather seat stretched across the front. A seat that was, as Dad wrote, as darkly blue-black as a pallbearer's suit. A pair of small glass sliding windows separated this compartment from the rear, so that anyone groaning inside a coffin could probably not be heard. A week after acquiring the vehicle, Mom announced, "You aren't going to school here in September, Brian. Your father and I will tutor you in Mexico." We were going to Mexico in the hearse. Dad's American Samoa assignment hadn't materialized, so he and Mom were putting together an alternate trip to the tropics, to more familiar climes. It would be a working trip for the benefit of their writing, as on their Kelly Butte adventure and on our earlier trip to Mexico. Dad had been tinkering with a novel based upon a famous Santa Rosa murder case, which he entitled Story Ship. The case of Joseph A. Doherty, who stabbed his wife 7 times and subsequently pled insanity, saying that this had to do with the 7 sacraments of the Bible, and that Christ had put the knife in his hands to kill. Ralph Slattery was called as an expert witness and testified that Doherty was insane. The jury ruled otherwise and convicted Doherty of first-degree murder. He was executed at San Quentin in 1954. He wanted to complete it in Mexico, along with 10 or 15 short stories. Mom planned to rewrite her rejected murder mystery, Frighten the Mother. The hearse, which became like a van or panel truck to our family, was black, with big rounded front fenders. It had chapel-shaped doors and pewter scrolls and candelabra on the sides of the rear compartment. Dad painted the top silver, concurring with Mom's opinion that it would reflect tropical heat better than the original black. He and Mom also painted the chapel doors bright yellow, just for fun. This would distinguish the vehicle, they thought, from a normal working hearse. Bruce and I received a battery of shots to ward off tropical diseases. Penny, who had been staying with us recently on Marine View Drive, would not go with us. While making preparations for the trip, Dad enjoyed driving around Tacoma in a dark suit, impersonating an undertaker. At the Cadillac dealership, where he had the car checked and tuned up, he forced the service manager to shake his hand. To his glee, he noticed the fellow then wiped his hand on his coveralls, assuming the hearse driver had been handling bodies. So Dad fiendishly maneuvered another handshake with the poor fellow, and soon afterward saw him make a beeline for the washroom. Frank Herbert was not a patient man. In restaurants, while waiting for food, he often turned into a grouchy bear. To his delight, he discovered that restaurant operators were uncomfortable with a hearse parked outside, and set everything else aside to get food for the driver. "Wouldn't you prefer takeout, sir?" one manager asked, after Dad went in and requested a table. The manager glanced nervously outside at the long vehicle parked by the front door. "No, thank you," Dad replied in a halting voice. "My doctor says I need to slow down. I wouldn't want to end up..." He cast a sidelong glance at the hearse. "Well, you know." Even fast food drive-in restaurants accelerated when he drove up. He and Mom liked fried chicken from one takeout place in Tacoma, and over a couple of weeks he pulled up to the window several times to order either two or four complete chicken dinners. It reached the point where he noticed employees running around inside before he even reached the window. Someone would see him pulling in, and the order would go out for chicken. Around this time, Dad was waiting at a stoplight in the right-hand lane of a four-lane road, an event he described in The Invisible Car. Up from behind came a hot rod packed with eight teenagers. They turned the corner behind me on two wheels, thundered to a stop in the lane at my left. I looked down, met eight pairs of staring eyes. "Drive carefully," I said, voice sepulcher. The light turned green. Gently, with the most delicate and sedate application of throttle, they eased across the intersection. I chose that moment to prove the invisible car would go from stop to 65 in 9 seconds. Just before heading for Mexico, Dad bolted a heavy steel ball on the steering wheel of the hearse. The ball, which had been on a number of Herbert-owned cars, resembled a trailer hitch and was a handy thing to hold on to. But if a driver happened to be wearing long sleeves, the knob could become caught in the sleeve, in the opening by the button. Thus it became commonly known as a suicide knob. Despite my father's vast reservoir of knowledge, this important statistical fact eluded him for many years. As a result, we rode to Mexico in a hearse, and the guy driving it had a suicide knob in his grip. Into the big, heavy vehicle we loaded double-wall cardboard boxes and trunks of our personal property, stacking them up to the bottom of the little sliding glass windows that separated the front and rear compartments. We took an old green Elna sewing machine, a pair of Olympia typewriters, several boxes of typing paper, two footlockers that had been up Kelly Butte by mule, a reel-to-reel tape recorder, tools and spare parts for the car, tape recordings of my parents' favorite music, fishing gear, camera equipment, toys, clothes, and maybe even a kitchen sink somewhere in the midst. Dad brought along a complete medical kit with antibiotics, hypodermics, tourniquets, and snakebite paraphernalia, as well as several brand-new medical books, including Cecil's Textbook of Medicine and the Merck Manual. On top of our belongings, Dad placed a layer of DFPA plywood, and above that, several soft blankets. Bruce and I rode back there, with lots of room. I had my cocker spaniel Dusty with me, my best buddy, and he scrambled around happily, licking our faces. In The Invisible Car, Dad referred to our hearse as a traveling arena, a wrestling mat with wheels. He installed a top rack on the hearse, where we carried a spare tire. Two gray canvas water bags were tied to the grill, draped across the front. Since we were moving out of the rental house, arrangements had to be made for every article of personal property we owned. Items were sold or donated to charity, books were left in storage with friends, and clothing and other articles were shipped to Penny in Florence, Oregon, along with a child support check for her mother. On the September morning that we set out, Dad was in an incredibly good mood, singing and making witty quips about road signs. Whenever he saw a sign that read, "Stop ahead," he exclaimed, "Stop! Ahead in the road!" Dad did all the driving, since Mom was afraid to drive and didn't have a license. As the days wore on, he grew tired and increasingly testy, largely because Dusty was not waiting for rest stops to do his doggy duty. Instead, he picked a corner in the back, and by the second day, a distinct, unpleasant aroma wafted from that vicinity. His feces and urine had soaked through the blankets, and some got around the plywood onto our things below. By the time we reached Ralph and Irene Slattery's house in Sonoma, California, Mom and Dad had endured enough of Dusty. They arranged to leave him with the Slatteries. The hearse had a tendency to slip out of low gear, from having been driven in first gear during so many funeral processions. Dad had to hold the gear shift down at times to keep it from popping out of place. Sometimes, when he wanted to keep the hearse in low gear, he had Bruce or me hold the gear shift down, pressing on it so that it wouldn't slip. It was a three-on-a-tree shift on the right side of the steering column. I remember warm California and Southwest nights on the highway, with my parents' heads silhouetted against low evening light from headlights on the road. There were flea-bitten motel rooms with no air conditioning and the windows left open. Crickets sang outside, and I smelled dry grass, cattle, fertilizers, and warm, sweltering earth. At the border, the Mexican officers performed a cursory inspection of our belongings. Luckily, they didn't remove the door panels, or they would have discovered Dad's concealed automatic pistol, which he carried for protection. As our hearse rolled through Mexico on its journey south, peasants fell to their knees or held straw hats over their hearts. Devout Catholics, they undoubtedly thought we were carrying a poor departed soul on its final earthly journey. As soon as we left the first village in which this occurred and were on the open highway, Dad and Mom broke out laughing. They laughed so hard that tears streamed down their faces, and Dad had to pull the car over. We didn't have much money with us, only around $3,000 in U.S. currency and traveler's checks. But prices were so low that we could live quite well, much better than in the United States. Some of the Mexican hotels in which we stayed were almost palatial, with floral-decked central patios and fine furnishings. Dad was sure he would be able to write in Mexico to boost our monetary reserve, though years later he would refer to this belief as founded in myth. One day he would become a student of modern mythology and its correlation with individual and mass psychology. Myths were all around us, he said. The myth of owning a sailboat or a ranch, for example, or of being a great writer without having to work hard at the craft. Or the idyllic myth he found himself seeking now, after the brief Mexican jaunt of 1953 and the failed American Samoa attempt. Frank Herbert now envisioned himself in a remote tropical village, pounding out a literary masterpiece on a manual typewriter. He'd sold several short stories in 1954. There were fewer short story sales in 1955, but that year he made the important novel sale, Under Pressure. And before leaving for Mexico, he received word from his agent that a movie producer was interested in the book. We passed through the bustling shopping town of Toluca, just west of Mexico City, then followed a highway northwest. Our destination was the mountain village of Tlalpujahua in the state of Michoacán. This had been recommended by Mike Cunningham, an American friend with whom we had rendezvoused in the last few days. He drove ahead of us in his old wood-paneled station wagon, kicking up clouds of dust on a long dirt road leading to the village. Near Tlalpujahua, the road narrowed and jungle closed in around us. A number of houses dotted the overgrowth in tiny carved-out clearings. Some were tin-roofed shacks, while others were constructed of more sturdy adobe with tile roofs. Many had outdoor kitchens in the form of lean-to arrangements against the houses. I smelled the acrid odor of cook fires from the burning of dry brush, grass, and burro dung. Daylight faded, and after dark we arrived in Tlalpujahua, where we stayed with a friend of Mike's. Soon we rented a one-story adobe and white stucco house with a wrought iron gate and a heavy carved wooden door. It was set up in a U-shaped arrangement of rooms around a central outdoor courtyard. The 14-room home belonged to Señorita Francisca Aguilar, a large woman known as Señorita Panchita. Since costs were so low, we could afford to hire a maid, a live-in cook, and a gardener. Almost every day, Dad wrote from early in the morning until early afternoon on Storyship, alternate title, As Heaven Made Him, his novel about the Santa Rosa murder case, dealing with the legal definition of sanity and the responsibility of a criminal for his acts. The novel had both moral and political content, making it potentially pedantic. Each day, Mom set up her own portable typewriter on the dining room table and worked on revisions to her mystery novel, Frighten the Mother. She didn't put in as many hours as Dad, since she spent more time than he in managing household affairs, including the household help and the children. Unfortunately, she was having trouble with the story. When my parents' work was finished for the day, they enjoyed taking walks through town together. I remember playing marbles and looking up to see them across the street, holding hands and talking. They waved to me and smiled and went on their way. They had a spot they liked to visit at sunset, where they could look across the burnt orange tile roofs of the town at a magnificent sky filled with color. As in every other place we lived, the mail was critically important to my father. Here it was more essential than ever, since we had no telephone. Contract offers, documents, and checks were expected to arrive in the mail, he told us, and for that reason all mail was to be treated with extreme care. We got to know our mailman, Jesus Chaco, very well. A slender, affable man, he was always punctual. When he delivered a check one day in payment for an article Dad had written, $125 U.S., my father said to my mother, "Jesus brings manna from heaven." Unfortunately, Doubleday mailed the galley proof of under pressure to our previous address in Tacoma, and it wasn't forwarded to us in Mexico. Consequently, a duplicate galley had to be mailed to Dad. This became a matter of extreme urgency due to the publisher's schedule, so the moment Dad had the galley, he worked without sleep until it was corrected and in the mail back to New York. Doubleday did not like the title Under Pressure and asked the author for an alternate. He preferred the original title, but suggested The Dragon in the Sea nonetheless, which was used for the hardcover Doubleday edition. In many respects, the new title was superior for the mythology it suggested. There is an ancient Chinese legend concerning a ferocious, terrifying dragon that lives in the sea. The Bible, Isaiah 27:1, contains a similar description, "And the Lord shall slay the dragon that is in the sea." These passages, particularly the latter for Western readers, added subconscious depth and meaning to the title. In my father's tale, the dragon was a nuclear-powered sub-tug that transported precious oil through wartime waters, a craft that guarded the cargo against anyone who would harm it. This craft was reminiscent of mythological beasts of legend guarding a great treasure. The mythology of such beasts was described by Sir James George Frazer in his massive 19th-century magnum opus, The Golden Bough, one of my father's favorite and most closely studied works. Frazer described the golden fleece of the sacred ram sacrificed to Zeus, given by Phrixus to his wife's father and nailed to an oak tree, where it was guarded by a dragon that never slept. In Beowulf, also read by my father, a ferocious fire dragon occupied a lair under the cliffs at the edge of the sea, guarding a great treasure hoard. This theme would later become central to Frank Herbert's Dune, a world in which massive, fire-breathing sandworms guarded the greatest treasure in the universe, the spice melange. As in The Dragon in the Sea, the treasure was beneath the surface of a planet. Oil and melange were alike, because whoever controlled the precious limited resource controlled the known universe, as described in each novel. There were no banks in Tlalpujahua, so we banked in El Oro, 7 miles away by dirt road. This was fitting, since El Oro meant the gold. We also did some of our shopping there, particularly for medicines, which were in short supply in Tlalpujahua. Many times Mom went to El Oro alone on the second-class bus, while Dad stayed home and wrote. The bus passengers frequently carried live chickens or turkeys on board, and even pigs, going to or from the market. In her travel journal, My mother described what the front of the passenger compartment looked like from the inside. The bus was loaded, but a comparatively elegant 50-year-old specimen. Above the driver's head were decals of bombers, pictures of the Virgin, and a painted replica of a sway curtain on the top of the windshield, imitation of purple plush with gold fringe. To that I would add my own memory of Mexican bus drivers, who had an unnerving habit of crossing themselves in the Catholic way, touching their forehead and each shoulder, and then pressing the accelerator pedal all the way to the floorboard, as if the fate of the bus and passengers depended solely upon the will of God and not upon the skill of the driver. On a regular basis at our house, my parents conducted an English class for local adults. The brightest student was 21-year-old José Pepe Muñoz, who was fast becoming a close friend of our family. Pepe wore white T-shirts and stood around 5'7". A muscular man, he had long black hair and a round Tarascan Indian face. He smiled often and easily, had a pleasant manner and a good sense of humor. Like many people in town, he was muy católico, very Catholic. A master woodworker, he was exceedingly honest in a number of financial dealings with my parents. I spent a good deal of my time playing marbles in the streets, and was outdoors so much that townspeople referred to me as El Vago de los Calles, the tramp of the streets. The friends I made were not to my mother's liking. Her journal entry of November 9, 1955 reported, "This morning the tailor stopped Frank to tell him that the kids Brian is playing with are very grosero, rough and coarse, and are teaching him horrible words in Spanish, which he shouts at the top of his lungs. The children described attend the government school here. Went to the plaza with Frank and discovered Brian shouting, 'Señorita Panchita has a big fat stomach,' in perfect Spanish. Had a talk with him. Initially, our family was not well accepted by the community. Dad wrote in, 'God's helping hand gave us 5,000 amigos,' and 'The Curate's Thumb,' both unpublished first-person accounts, that the villagers were independent and inclined to form their own opinions. These were clannish, proud, and fiercely nationalistic mountain people. Americans were considered a bad influence upon the local youth. Adults ignored my parents or spoke about them in whispered tones. Some children were forbidden from playing with me or with my little brother. In October, the valve caps were stolen from our hearse tires, apparently by someone who did not fear the vengeance of God for tampering with a vehicle bearing chapel doors. A short while later, the side mirrors were also taken. All of this was a surprise and a disappointment to us, in view of the religious upbringing of the people. Elsewhere in town, interesting events were occurring. It was a story my father told many times at dinner tables in ensuing years. His two unpublished versions of it, God's Helping Hand and The Curate's Thumb, differed in minor details. The most important man in town was the Catholic curate, Francisco Aguilar. Known as Señor Cura, he was in his 70s. With more influence than a parish priest, his jurisdiction covered Tlalpujahua and 5 smaller nearby villages, including Tlalpujahuilla, Little Tlalpujahua. The village mayors always visited him in his large home for approval before making important decisions. He stood 6'6", weighed 275 pounds, and had a pock-rutted face from an earlier attack of smallpox. The curate suffered from diabetes and had to watch his diet closely. Consequently, the local physician, Dr. Gustav Iriarte, checked in on him regularly. Dr. Gus, as he was known affectionately, stood under 5 feet tall, weighed 100 pounds, and wore large eyeglasses, giving him a scholarly appearance. He had a feisty, combative nature. While I was playing on cobblestone streets, Dad was across town. He had encountered Señor Cura on the street and was talking with him. The curate had his hand wrapped in a dirty rag. When Dad asked him about it, he was told it was only a small scratch caused by a thorn. Frank Herbert asked to see the hand. Slowly, Grimacing with pain, the holy man unwrapped it. My father nearly gagged when he smelled the putrid odor of gangrene, an odor he had smelled 2 decades before and had never forgotten. The hand was swollen to nearly double its normal size, with an ugly, infected gash running between the thumb and forefinger. Dad told the curate he was in danger of losing the hand and perhaps his life from infection, and that he needed immediate medical attention. The curate's condition, my father knew, was complicated by diabetes, which created a number of potential problems. Since Dr. Gus was in Mexico City, Dad offered to drive him to El Oro to see a doctor, or even to Toluca, farther away, where better medical care was available. The offer was declined. "God will take care of me," Señor Cura said. Dad wondered if the curate considered the hearse an improper mode of conveyance under the circumstances, a sacrilege. In any event, the elderly gentleman was adamantly opposed to getting in it. The curate also expressed an aversion toward doctors, which may in fact have been fear. Besides, he insisted, he wasn't convinced his wound was that serious. After all, it was only a little scratch from a thorn bush. Señor Cura rewrapped his hand. "Would you permit me to apply some medicines?" Frank Herbert asked. "I have a medical kit with antibiotics to make you feel better." The old man thought for a moment, then consented. Something in the manner of this Norte Americano was reassuring. My father was taking a tremendous risk, for he could be charged with negligence and sent to Mexican prison if the curate died. But he tried not to think about that. Señor Cura was brought to our house, and at the dining room table, Dad brought out his medical books and supplies. After comparing instructions in the books, he soaked the wound in hot water with Epsom salts. This reduced the swelling. He then covered the cut with sulfur and put on a clean bandage. He also administered a shot of penicillin after calculating the necessary cc's based upon the curate's weight. At the curate's house, Dad gave the housekeeper 2 bottles of terramycin, oxytetracycline antibiotic pills, telling her to make absolutely certain the old man took the pills 6 times a day, with plenty of water. Dad was so worried during ensuing days that he could hardly write. The first thing every morning, he hurried over to the curate's house. There he inspected the hand, applied more sulfa, and changed the bandage. After 2 days, the swelling diminished substantially, and the wound showed definite signs of improvement. When Dr. Gus returned and heard what happened, he went to Señor Cura and shouted in Spanish, "Stupid man! I've told you about infections. Señor Herbert saved your life." The following day, my father was amazed to see me playing marbles in the street with several boys. When I looked up and saw him, I asked, "Is it true what they're saying, Dad? You saved Señor Cura's life?" After a moment of astonishment, he broke into a broad smile and said, "Well, I did help out a little." Soon we learned that Dr. Gus had been telling everyone in town about the heroics of my father. In the middle of the night, someone reattached the mirrors to our hearse and returned the valve caps. For the first time, my brother and I were invited inside the homes of neighbors to play with their children. Quite suddenly, Frank Herbert became a renowned wise man in those parts. Villagers consulted him on important matters and referred to him affectionately as Don Pancho. We were invited to parties and picnics. Dad joined the village men's club. Just before dawn on his Saint's Day, a Roman Catholic feast day in honor of St. Francis of Paola, dozens of villagers carrying candles serenaded him from the street in front of our house with a cheerful good morning song, Mañanita, accompanied by a mariachi band. My family stood in the doorway in robes and pajamas, smiling and waving. In her journal, my mother wrote, "Fiesta at night with music and the upper and lower classes of town. First guests to arrive, the town's 3 prostitutes. Left right away. Killed whole sheep for fiesta. Plenty of beer and refrescos. Cold drinks." finally had to isolate more solid citizens of town in the dining room. Tequila, agua caliente beer, dry mutton, more agua caliente. Successful fiesta. Mike and Frank passed out. Pepe, official bartender, tucked two gringos into bed. All guests went to door of Frank's room, serenaded him. He waved feebly. With his background in farming and the assistance of U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA reference materials he'd mailed home under senatorial franking privileges while working in Washington, D.C., Dad showed Senor Cura the proper method of pruning and spraying his orange, lemon, and peach trees. Word spread, and soon Dad began advising villagers on gardening and farming techniques. He became, as he wrote in one of his unpublished pieces, the unofficial farm advisor for the region, covering all the villages in the curate's jurisdiction. Local nuns requested my father's expert assistance at their convent, where the fruit trees were barren. Mom was quite amused by them. The nuns were charming. They fluttered helplessly around, told him they had complete confidence in his tree surgery, watched in fascination as he cut off excess shoots, even hung speechless on his words on pollinization. While he lived in Tlalpujahua, Frank Herbert translated key sections of USDA books and pamphlets into Spanish. The church mimeographed this information, stapled copies together, and distributed them to farmers. The future author of an ecological masterpiece then visited farms to provide further advice and wrote to the USDA for additional information. Farm tracts in the region were known as milpas, which were jungle areas cleared by burning, then farmed for a few years and ultimately abandoned when the soil no longer contained the nutrients to sustain good crop yields. To inhibit soil erosion and control water runoff, Dad told the farmers to minimize the use of fire for land clearing, since that robbed the soil of important nutrients. He instructed them in contour plowing, terracing, water diversion systems, and in the planting of grasses, trees, and shrubs. These methods were especially useful in a region of heavy tropical rains. Soils hit by deluges could not absorb water nearly as well as they did in slow rains. Soil instability caused by rains hitting inadequately planted areas had resulted in mud inundating the old village and in continuous damage to planting areas over the years. In ensuing years, my father would do more research, including a visit to an agricultural research station in Oregon that was studying the control of sand dunes, which are in extreme state of erosion. His understanding of the importance of grass and other plantings in inhibiting soil erosion would one day form an integral part of the ecology of dune. Generally, Dad was in high spirits during our stay in Tlalpujahua, and my brother and I received less severe discipline from him than usual. I understood, as did the rest of my family, that my father did not like to be interrupted when he was writing. Others failed to get the message. This included our only American friend in town, Mike Cunningham. Frequently, when Mike wanted to talk with Dad, he couldn't get through, since Dad was invariably in his study behind a closed door, connected to his typewriter as if it were an extension of him. When Frank Herbert was writing, he was in a different universe, and no one could get through to him except my mother, his moat dragon, as he liked to say. Our gardener, Beto, despite repeated warnings, interrupted my father once too often, and my mother reported the aftermath. Frank exploded, justifiably, I believe, at Beto's interruptions when he wanted to write. Frank was in a purple pet and got me so upset I felt like crying. In punishment for his many interruptions, the gardener was forced to prepare a sign for the study door. The sign warned anyone who came near, in Spanish, not to touch the door while the master of the house was working. One of the worst disruptions occurred late one afternoon while Dad was in his study reading his manuscript to Mom. She emerged to take care of the problem and found several upset people, including our friends and the household help. The center of controversy was our cook, who was accusing the maid of purchasing inferior lemons from the market. Dad was frustrated trying to write in Mexico, and not only about the lack of quiet time in which to work. He also became sick with dysentery on a number of occasions. Following one such attack, he commented to my mother, "Maybe it's cheaper not to come to Mexico, because of work days lost through illness." She reported other physical problems experienced by my father. Said altitude too high for much exercise. The altitude here, almost 8,000 feet, is too much for Frank. A little exercise wears him out completely. Wants to settle closer to sea level. Late in 1955, under a contract of 300 pesos a month from my father, Pepe Munoz removed the gaudy chapel siding from the hearse and built plywood panels in their place. This reduced the vehicle weight by 500 pounds, thus improving fuel efficiency. He then brush-painted the entire hearse a creamy tan color, further removing evidence of its somber past. Dad finished his second novel, Story Ship, and mailed it to Lurton. The agent said he liked it, particularly suspense elements and characterizations, but Doubleday turned it down. John Campbell didn't want it for Astounding Science Fiction either, asserting it was more detective story than science fiction, a historically unsuccessful combination in the publishing world. Rejections followed from other publishers, some of whom thought the yarn had too many science fiction gimmicks, with an inadequately organized plot and too much preaching. He was being pedantic, having crossed the fine and dangerous line between moral instruction and entertainment. Mom couldn't seem to overcome the problems with her own novel, primarily involving the organization of material. She found herself losing enthusiasm for it, with an increasing belief that she could never make it as a novelist. Writing sales were supposed to finance our extended stay in Mexico, but now we were once again nearly out of money. Mom made arrangements to borrow from her Aunt Ruth and Uncle Bing, and Dad borrowed from his favorite aunt, Peg Roundtree. Just enough money came in to get us back to the Pacific Northwest. One piece of good literary news reached us in Mexico. The New York Times ran an excellent review on The Dragon in the Sea in their book review section. This did not, however, result in the instant funding we needed. A movie producer was still interested in the book, as he had been for several months, but thus far had made no offer. My parents liked Pepe Munoz so much that they wanted to sponsor him in the United States, bringing him into the country as a new citizen. Although Dad made repeated, glaring errors in raising his children, he could be extremely generous with friends. No idea was too wild for him. He was impulsive and childlike. The commitment to bring Pepe to the United States, so like Frank Herbert, was made on the spur of the moment, without considering details, without worrying about problems. No matter the red tape required to complete the task, and it was considerable, involving a number of delays and uncertainties in Mexico City. No matter our lack of funds and lack of prospects, no matter bald tires on the family car, we were about to drive more than 3,000 miles north on yet another adventure. Just before we departed from Tlalpujahua in early 1956, the villagers staged a big daytime fiesta in honor of my father. In gratitude, Dad and Mom put on a big party of their own that evening, held in our courtyard. A mariachi band played from the covered walkway overlooking the garden. A few days later, we pulled out of Tlalpujahua and headed north, with Pepe sitting in the front seat between my parents. The tires on our hearse were in bad shape. We only had a little borrowed money, not enough for contingencies. Luck would have to be with us, or we wouldn't make it. Pepe hung a silver Virgin of Carmen medal on the dashboard, a medal that had been blessed by Señor Cura. This, the curate said, would protect us on our long journey. Despite this, the tires on the hearse went flat constantly from rough road conditions, and Pepe and Dad used the jack and star wrench repeatedly. We limped from gas station to gas station, patching the beaten-up old skins and heading out again. I remember sitting in the back of the hearse as we drove along a high mountain road and looking out the window on my mother's right at a sheer drop-off. It was a long way down, at least 1,000 feet. I was only mildly concerned. The drop-off held my attention, but I was only a kid and hadn't lived long enough to really get frightened. I hadn't learned how many things could go wrong. As far as I was concerned, Dad was invincible. Nothing could overpower him. As long as he was at the wheel, we were okay. Of course, I didn't know about suicide knobs on steering wheels then, how they could get caught in long shirt sleeves and cause terrible accidents. One day, they would be made illegal for this reason. Dad was a risk-taker, one of the features of his personality that made him interesting. But bald tires and a suicide knob on a dangerous mountain road? In a hearse? He had to be pushing his luck.
Chapter 10. Easy Pie. Early in 1956, the Herbert hearse limped into Portland, Oregon, and we rented a tiny one-story house on the north side, not far from the St. John's Bridge. Pepe Munoz, known as Joe Munoz now, stayed with us and worked at a local cabinet shop as a carpenter. Money was tight. Dad and Mom set about trying to obtain real jobs. They were finding it too difficult to make ends meet as writers. Still, my father was on a course that would one day lead to success. From an early stage of his writing, Frank Herbert was tuned in to the problem of finite resources on this planet. At a time of increasing and wasteful consumer consumption in the United States, he saw, quite accurately, that it could not last forever. In The Dragon in the Sea, he predicted the global oil shortage that would occur 2 decades later. One day, in Dune, he would make similar predictions about finite resources, particularly water.
Frank Herbert told me that he invented containerized shipping in Dragon, which was later made commercially successful by the Japanese. A number of other commercial ventures have been undertaken based upon this idea, including one by an English company, Dracon, utilizing sub-tugs that were very similar to the novel. Also, General Dynamics came out with a submarine tanker, a fully contained sub designed to transport oil from the Arctic under the ice to ice-free ports in Greenland or Newfoundland. And Gianfranco Germani, an Italian, recently constructed giant bladders to transport fresh water from watersheds to parched regions of the earth.
In creating these novels, he asked himself the question, what if? Extrapolating from conditions that existed at the time, he envisioned worlds of startling, frightening clarity. Submariners contacted my father over the years and told him that Dragon accurately depicted the psychological pressures of undersea crewmen, despite the fact that the author had never served on a submarine. This ability to imagine conditions he had never experienced would serve Frank Herbert well later in the creation of Dune. But Portland in 1956 was nearly a decade before Dune, and 15 years before book sales would begin to take off for Frank Herbert. We were poor, a not uncommon experience for artists and writers who were ahead of their time. All in all, Dragon was doing fairly well for a first novel, although it was not earning the kind of money needed to support a family. Reviews, those few that appeared, were favorable. Based upon the book, Dad was nominated, but did not win in the category of Most Promising New Author at the 1956 World Science Fiction Convention.
A rumor began to circulate in the 1960s that The Dragon in the Sea tied with William Golding's Lord of the Flies for the 1955 International Fantasy Award. This was inaccurate. For many years, my parents even believed Dragon had shared the award, and it was reported incorrectly that Frank Herbert was the only writer ever to win all three major science fiction awards, the Nebula, the Hugo, and the International Fantasy Award.
No one wanted to publish his new 40,000-word novel Story Ship, a book in which he had placed a lot of hope. For a while, Amazing Stories considered running a magazine serial on it, if Dad could trim it to 30,000 words. They were offering what Lurton referred to derisively as salvage money, only $400. Lurton was opposed to accepting this, and recommended instead adding 10,000 words to the length, since 50,000 words would put it into a length preferred by pocketbooks. The pockets would pay more as well, he said, and there would be more prestige in publishing it as a novel than in a chopped-up serial form. Dad was in a quandary. He went over the manuscript again and decided to go against Lurton's advice. Amazing's offer was a bird in the hand, Dad felt. Besides that, he said, the story didn't seem stretchable to him. He told Lurton to contact Amazing, and a verbal agreement was reached. If the required number of words were cut, they promised to look at the story again, and in all likelihood would publish it. My father set to work on the rewrite, and within a few weeks had it in the mail. Amazing delayed, and ultimately decided against publishing the story at all. Dad was furious, and tossed the butchered manuscript in the back of a closet. For many years, he refused to look at it again. Ultimately, it became part of his 1968 novel, The Heaven Makers. Most of Storyship was written in Mexico, and the project's failure put a damper on future exotic trips. Thus far, neither tropical sojourn had worked out creatively, exposing the fallacy of such trips to him. He began to recognize them for the myths that they were. Bits and pieces of the Mexican experience did find their way into Frank Herbert's writing over the years. In the short story, You Take the High Road, Astounding Science Fiction, May 1958, the towns on an alien planet had cobblestone central marketplaces. A decade later, he would publish a nonfiction newspaper piece about shopping in Mexico. But most of all, Mexican scenes and descriptions appeared in unpublished stories. Stories he couldn't sell for one reason or another. In the 1950s, Dad didn't fully commit himself to science fiction. He displayed flashes of brilliance in the genre, earning accolades, but then withdrew or changed direction, turning instead to mainstream stories he hoped would sell to Saturday Evening Post, The New Yorker, Life, or Reader's Digest. Increasingly, he tried to get away from science fiction, feeling it was dominated by the pulps and inane monster films. With his intellectual leanings, he didn't want to be identified with nonsensical non-literature, didn't want to have to keep explaining to people that he didn't write the trashy material known as sci-fi, that he wrote instead a more sophisticated thinking man's variety. Still, deep in his heart, he loved the elbow room afforded by science fiction. It was a field where his imagination could stretch to the limits, and this was a man of remarkable imagination. In science fiction, he could write allegories filled with symbolism. In 1956, we owed money to the IRS that we were unable to pay. After receiving his advance on The Dragon in the Sea the year before, Dad didn't think of setting aside funds for the payment of taxes on this income. Naively, he and Mom just took off for Mexico, thinking only of the adventures ahead of them. Any thoughts of income taxes were only vagrant, soon slipping away. There would be future story sales anyway, they reasoned, and everything would take care of itself. Now, with that myth shattered, old bill collectors and their attorneys were contacting us, demanding money. Again, Flora wanted past due child support payments. Around the house, my father kept saying we were broke, or even worse, flat broke. On those rare occasions when we had people over for dinner, Dad used a code phrase with us. If there was not enough food for us to have second helpings, he would say FHB, NMIK, which meant family hold back, no more in kitchen. On the other hand, if we could have seconds, he would utter the much more blissful letters, MIK, more in kitchen. Mom found a job as a fashion advertising copywriter for a large department store in town, Olds and King. Since it was an election year, Dad accepted a speechwriter position with Phil Hitchcock, who was running in the Republican primary for U.S. Senator from Oregon. Hitchcock was a professor at Lewis and Clark College in Oregon and a state senator since 1948. He had been a Republican candidate for U.S. Senator in 1954, before Guy Corden beat him in the Republican primary. Now it was 2 years later, with another primary election coming up, and he was facing former Secretary of the Interior Douglas McKay for the Republican nomination. McKay had also been an Oregon state senator and governor of the state. He was a formidable opponent. Unfortunately, Hitchcock lost the May 18, 1956 primary election to McKay. So once more, Frank Herbert was out of a job. Joe Munoz was rarely around because of his job and busy social calendar. He was dating blonde American girls, and life was good for him. He smoked little black cigarettes. Every month he sent money back to his family in Mexico. It was a time of stress for our family, and I was not getting along with my father. A pattern of severe discipline from Dad set in, a resumption of our relationship before the last Mexico trip. Now it was worse than ever. If Dad was riding when I arrived home from school, I had to tiptoe around the house. It wasn't a very big house, so I had to be especially careful. Sometimes I came around the house and heard music playing from inside. Dad developed the habit of writing to music, played on a large reel-to-reel tape deck in his study. With this buffer of sound between him and me, I would open the front door quietly and creep into my room, or would lie on the floor in the living room with a book, listening to the music. It was powerful, vibrant material. Brahms, Vivaldi, Beethoven, Gershwin, even Peter and the Wolf, which I especially enjoyed.
When The Dragon in the Sea was printed by Doubleday in hardcover, Dad entered my room and handed me a signed copy.
A slender black volume with yellow lettering on the spine. It had a bright blue, yellow, and black dust jacket and bore a $2.95 retail price. He dedicated the story to the men of the United States Submarine Service. In reflection of the gap between us, perhaps, Dad penned this inscription to me on the flyleaf at the beginning of the book. To Number One Son, in hopes it will help him along the complicated path of understanding his father, Frank Herbert. After he left my room, I glanced at the first page and noted something about an Ensign Ramsey who looked like a grown-up Tom Sawyer, but didn't read further for many years. Still, I kept his book on a little bookshelf in my room, in plain view. Frank Herbert demanded truth in government, consumer affairs, and environmental issues. He did not tolerate evasiveness, omissions, or half-truths. His blue eyes did not avert when he spoke to you. In the coming decade, in Dune, he would write of truth-sayers, remarkable witches who could determine truth or falsehood from watching and listening to a person. Dad was, by his own admission, a man obsessed with turning over stones to see what would scurry out, with unmasking lies. This was evident in his dealings with his children. He had a World War II lie detector, a U.S. Navy unit, a small black box with a dial. It had ominous wires and a gray cuff that he wrapped tightly around my arm. The first time he used the machine on me, he accused me of secretly hitting my brother, and he was going to get the truth out of me. He said the lie detector always revealed falsehood, which was not, as I would learn later, exactly the case. Admittedly, I was lying about hitting my brother, and the machine indicated this, so I got a licking. After that, he used the lie detector on me regularly, and on Bruce. If anything came up, such as an item missing from his desk or questions about where I had been after school, he would say, in a clipped voice, "I'm putting you on the lie detector. Let's go in the other room." With that, he would grab my arm and lead me to the machine. On the way, I broke out in a sweat, rehearsing what I would say and how I would say it. Would he ask such and such? My mind was a whirl, full of terror. The machine was kept in his study, and he only brought it out when I was in trouble. It was set up on a wooden table, with two straight-back chairs pulled up to it, one on each side. He pointed to one of the chairs, and I slipped into it, shaking. Towering over me, he plugged the machine in and tapped it a couple of times for effect, ostensibly to free a sticky needle. A bare ceiling bulb threw his hulking shadow across the table. "Roll up your left sleeve," he said gruffly. Shaking, I complied, and he wrapped the sensor cuff around my arm. A stream of questions and accusatory statements ensued from him, and like a prisoner undergoing the tortures of Grand Inquisitor Torquemada, perspiration poured from my brow. Dad was too smart, and phrased every query in the precise way that put me in the worst possible light. After each question, he studied the machine intently and invariably pronounced me guilty of something. According to Howie Hansen, who disapproved of the use of the device on Bruce and me, Dad had a way of rigging the machine to indicate that we were lying, even when we were telling the truth. One day my father would write of young Paul Atreides in Dune, ordered to place his hand into the blackness of a box in the ordeal of the Gom Jabbar. Paul was commanded not to withdraw the hand, no matter how much pain he felt, on penalty of death from a poison needle held at his neck, the deadly Gom Jabbar. Terrified, the boy complied. Pain throbbed up his arm. Sweat stood out on his forehead. Without turning his head, he tried to move his eyes to see that terrible needle poised beside his neck. He sensed that he was breathing in gasps, tried to slow his breaths, and couldn't. Pain. His world emptied of everything except that hand immersed in agony. His lips were so dry he had difficulty separating them. In Heretics of Dune, one of the sequels to Dune, Frank Herbert would describe a T-probe, a torturous memory detection device that absorbed every bit of information about a person. He could identify where it took over his muscles and senses. It was like another person sharing his flesh, preempting his own reactive patterns. It was a hellish device. It could command his body as though he had no thinking part in his own behavior. The whole spectrum of his senses could be copied into this T-probe and identified. The machine could trace those out as though it made a duplicate of him. It was my father's gift and curse that he noticed infinitesimally small details. This enabled him to become a great writer. He had a tendency, however, to be somewhat of a nitpicker in the household. He was extremely demanding. The Bene Gesserit of Dune understood nuances of meaning, subtle shiftings of voice and intonation. So it was with my father. He understood, or thought he understood, shades of meaning in every word his children uttered. He picked our sentences apart. "What do you mean you'll try to do it?" he would say to me in a voice reaching crescendo. "Don't ever use the word try on me. That word signifies failure, the likelihood of defeat. You'll do it, goddammit, Brian. You won't try to do it." Another intolerable word to him was can't. We didn't dare use that word or try, because they triggered something in the man, and he would fly into blind rages. If one of the verboten words slipped from my mouth, I immediately wanted it back, a second chance. But there the word was, floating in the air, reaching his ears, causing his demeanor to change, a ferocious scowl on his face, and loud commands from his ever-active mouth. I would cower and shake and watch for the threatening movements from his beefy right hand, the hitting hand. Of course, there was an element of philosophical and moral truth in his concept, that the words try and can't were weak, indicating a person was not strong of character and was incapable of taking responsibility for his own actions. It was an important lesson of life, one I think of often to this day. When I got to know my father many years later, I found, to my surprise, he was quite the opposite of what I had supposed. He was, in reality, a loving, caring man, but one who experienced problems with children. He was impatient around them, intolerant of youthful energies and mischief. It is true as well that Bruce and I were expected to undergo similar routines to those that Dad had experienced in his childhood. Frank Herbert, ever the psychoanalyst, might be surprised to realize that a major component of his own behavior was mimicry, of the subconscious variety. He imitated the stern disciplinary measures taken against him by his father, F.H., who had received them in turn from his own father, Otto. It is interesting to note a curious habit that Otto had while living in Burley in the 1930s, a habit my father saw firsthand. It seems that the old man enjoyed listening to the news on the radio, and when his programs were on, no one could disturb him, and no one spoke, at the risk of incurring his ire. Family members had to tiptoe around the house. My father first learned about lie detectors from his policeman father, F.H., who said to him in the 1930s, "There are methods of determining when a suspect is telling the truth and when he is lying. Subtle things to notice. His gaze, the way the mouth is held, nervous tics and mannerisms, moisture on skin surfaces." He told the boy about lie detection machines, and threatened to connect him to one if he didn't shape up. But he never actually brought a machine home. The lie detector was a complete admission of failure on my father's part as a parent. He couldn't communicate with his sons, hadn't taken the time to bond with us, to learn what made us tick. Instead, he tried to crush our will and spirit. There could be no deviation from the rules he prescribed. The environment around him had to be absolute serenity to keep his mind in order, so that he might create his great work. I never saw Dad lift a finger against Penny, who came to stay with us that summer. One time he did get into a battle of wills with the tall, blonde teenager. He insisted that she eat her dessert and then rubbed it into her hair when she refused to do so. For the most part, she didn't receive the brunt of his anger, which in its most severe form became physical. I think he felt boys could and should take more punishment in order to make men out of us. Despite our chronic poverty, Mom was exceedingly proper about etiquette, a carryover from her maternal grandmother, Ada Landis. One time Penny brought a loaf of bread in its wrapper to the dinner table, and my mother hurled the loaf across the kitchen. Mom taught us the proper technique of holding silverware and of sitting up straight as we ate. We were not to slurp drinks or soup, and bowls were always to be tipped away when we spooned the last of the soup, never toward us. A well-mannered person is never eager to eat, she said. Dad was around 35 or 36 at the time, and I remember a habit he had of bounding up and down the stairs of our front porch, skipping steps. From my perspective, he was an old duffer, and I couldn't believe he had that much energy. He was impatient to get wherever the staircase led, not a man to dawdle with each step. Frank Herbert had been clean-shaven since moving to Santa Rosa in 1949 for the job with the Press Democrat. 7 years later now, The Dragon in the Sea sold to a German publisher for a small amount of money, and the publisher wanted a book jacket photograph of him. Lurton said that readers in Europe expected writers to have beards, so Dad grew it back before having the photo taken. Mom said he looked nice in it, and he took a liking to it again. At first, Bruce, Penny, and I thought he looked pretty strange, but gradually we grew accustomed to the change. In the summer of 1956, a Republican candidate for the U.S. Congress, Phil Roth, offered Dad the position of public information officer, which he accepted. Roth was running against the Democratic incumbent, Edith Green.
Roth, who had been in the Civil Air Patrol during World War II, piloted his own single-engine Cessna airplane on the campaign circuit, with Roth for Congress painted on the sides.
After accompanying the candidate on one such trip, my father picked up a bouquet of long-stemmed red roses for Mom on the way home. He presented them to her at the front door. "You're a sight for sore eyes," Dad exclaimed to her. And she responded, "Sore eye, sore eye." Roth was a supporter of Indian rights and felt the reservation system was perpetuating second-class citizenship for them. Dad concurred with this position and contributed his own knowledge of Indian affairs to Roth's speeches. A decade and a half later, these concerns would find their way into one of Frank Herbert's greatest and most powerful stories, the mainstream novel of Indian rage, Soul Catcher. Unfortunately, Roth lost in the November general election. For the third time in 2 years, Dad found himself on the staff of a losing Republican candidate, and he was again thrown out of work. If any of the three had won, the career of Frank Herbert might have been dramatically different, for he could have become a political appointee. Early in December, my father made a startling announcement. He said we would no longer celebrate Christmas on Christmas Day. Instead, we would wait until Twelfth Night, January 6th, the way it was done in Mexico for children. Except in our case, it would apply to the entire family. He went on to explain that the Epiphany, January 6th, was an important Christian religious holiday, representing the day the manifestation of Jesus Christ appeared before the Magi. It got pretty tough for Bruce and me when Christmas came around, and other kids played outside with new bicycles and baseball mitts and model airplanes, while we had nothing. On Christmas Day, our tree had only a few presents under it, sent by friends and relatives. Mom and Dad started shopping the day after Christmas, picking up bargains at sales. It was great for their budget, but Bruce and I thought it left something to be desired. By December 30th, Bruce and I had raised such a ruckus about our presents that Dad agreed to let us open one gift a day between New Year's Day and January 6th. Dad and Mom selected the ones we could open first, and the best were saved for the last day. This practice continued for 3 years. Finally, after vociferous protestations and monumental whining, Bruce and I were successful in eliminating it from the Herbert household for all time. Chapter 11. They Stopped the Moving Sands. With the campaign wars over and the Roth election lost, Dad felt burned out. He'd been beating his head against political walls long enough and needed to get back to his writing. A number of stories had been churning in his mind, and he wanted to get them on paper. For a long time he had been intrigued by the effect of heroes upon human history. A student of the flawed, tragic heroes of Greek mythology and Shakespeare, he also studied the Gospels of a number of religions. He was especially intrigued with stories of great religious leaders, messiahs. Among his favorite nonfiction works were biographies of great leaders such as Alexander the Great, Napoleon, and Washington.
Employing his increasing understanding of psychology, he wanted to write a novel from the perspective of a hero, venturing deep into the character's psyche.
He sought to become that character as he wrote about him, understanding every motivation. He had faint sketches in mind, and some of the coloration, but no canvas and no plot. So he set the idea aside. Another story kicking around in his head was a mainstream adventure set in Mexico, with no science fiction content. 2 days after the election loss of November 6th, 1956, he was hard at work on a novelette entitled A Game of Authors. He finished it in January, 37,500 words, and sent it off to his agent. With this course change, Dad was targeting the mainstream magazine market, thinking he could earn more money with sales to slick East Coast magazines. But he hadn't done any market research. A critical error. He didn't understand what needed to be done for success. With severe space limitations, those publications were particularly finicky about length. Dad wrote each story from the seat of his pants, without considering length. With A Game of Authors, he was going full circle, moving away from science fiction and back to the adventures he had written in the 1940s. Dragon was doing relatively well, but Dad didn't feel entirely comfortable with science fiction. He hadn't intended to become a science fiction writer. It just happened.